Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Our guest today is Patrick Judge, who's a guitar player and songwriter known for his work with The Showdown and his current band, Demon Hunter. He joined them in 2009, and he's been on 8 of their records, and they really are one of my favorite bands out there and some of my favorite people. Let's get into it. Patrick Judge, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
It's an honor to have you here. Just out of curiosity, were you in The Showdown in 2007? Like, did you do Ozfest?
No, I was not a part of, the heyday of The Showdown. That was when Temptation Come My Way came out. We were friends with them at the time, but no, I wasn't in the band just yet.
Okay, so then we haven't toured together. But
no.
Anyhow, pleasure to meet you. Curious something about Demon Hunter from a guitar perspective. What do you find the most challenging part of it? Because, I'm very familiar with the band. What I've noticed, I'm just curious. To me, it seems like it's not about lots of notes or speed or anything like that. It's just the right notes and having the riff sound just right and the exact right riff for the part. And it's more just super song oriented. So I'm wondering, what's the biggest challenge as a guitar player?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. It's all songwriting. It's not technical by any means, especially like the really early DH stuff is incredibly simple to play. That's all songwriting. The hardest part is the way that Ryan writes. He doesn't know like a lick of theory. And so Jeremiah and I will laugh sometimes because he'll just do stuff that is technically, it's like, it's wrong. It's just always chromatic. So sometimes it's hard to wrap our brains around some of those riffs that he'll bring to the table. And that's probably the hardest part. But other than that, it's all songwriting.
It's interesting to think that he doesn't know any theory because those vocal harmonies are...
I think it's all ear. I think it's one of those things, like, I'm not the best with theory myself. Jeremiah always told me that I knew what I was doing. I just didn't know how to kind of say I knew what I was doing. And I think Ryan's probably the same way. I don't think you can do this for that long and not just eventually kind of know what you're talking about. I think he just is drawn to a lot of those really just chromatic riffs.
Interesting. So how do you go about wrapping your head around it?
Just practice. Because sometimes he will bring like an oddly timed riff or something. And if you're not the one that wrote it, sometimes it's hard to wrap your head around what exactly is happening and when the turnaround is happening. And so that's kind of what I mean by that.
Got it. Like when you hear a song, can you hear the chord numbers? You just know what they are in your head?
I think that I can now. I can hear the chord changes and I just kind of know what it's doing. Because like I said, myself and our drummer Yogi, we played for a country singer for like 5 years. During that time, you're playing shows that are 3-4 hours long. So a lot of those songs end up being the same chord structure and you just kind of learn what those changes sound like.
That makes sense. So that's interesting. So you find yourself in very song-oriented projects a lot. What do you find as maybe not the challenge of playing this stuff, but what do you find to be the most challenging thing about working with songwriter types?
That's a good question, because I mean, playing with Demon Hunter, the first record I didn't do, or the second that I did with the band, I didn't do any actual songwriting. I might change up a riff here and there, and I would do, you know, my solos, leads and stuff. But other than that, it was just kind of you step out of the way, and this is kind of Ryan's show. So he's writing the song. So I think the hard part, which has turned out not to be that difficult in the long run, was kind of inserting myself into that situation and bringing the songs that I am going to write to the table. Cause I don't, you're writing for a band that's definitely established. So trying to navigate that is it's kind of a weird thing. It's already, the band's been around for so long and now you're new guy bringing songs in here. So just trying to make that a seamless transition is rather difficult.
Do you think of Ryan's style when you're writing, or like, how does that work? Are you like, do you have Ryan in your head at all, or?
Well, I kind of wonder about that myself. I wonder, like, I am very aware of the drumming, like our drummer Yogi and Ryan, our singer. Like, I leave gaps for him to sing. So I'm aware of him while I'm writing, but I don't know if it's just being in the band as long as I have. I don't know if it's just learning songwriting from him. I can't help but kind of think of him as I'm doing that. I don't know that it's a conscious effort at this point.
He's a great songwriter.
When I was songwriting, I just started tracking everything. It could sound like a pop song, or like it could be anything. I just told him that I was going to send him anything and everything that I wrote. And I recorded every single thing, any little idea, didn't matter how small it was. I wasn't really thinking about it. I wasn't, and as far as like tone goes, forever, that was almost out of my hands completely. It was like, we worked with producer Aaron Sprinkle for a long time. That was his world, is dialing the tones. I think Ryan would, for every record, have kind of a vision of the guitar tone that he wanted. I did have, you know, input on that while I was there, but it was, I wasn't the final say when it came to guitar tones for a long time. When Jeremiah joined the band, him and I were always together, and you know, that's when him and I were maybe a little more involved in choosing the guitar tones.
Brown, I can tell you from experience, because I mix engineered the True Defiance album, Aaron Sprinkle's production is like some of the most meticulous I've ever come across. So like, it's super defined. The vision for what it should be is 100% there in the raw tracks. It's interesting because you don't always get that in raw tracks. Like, oftentimes there's a lot of room for the mixer to really do their own thing. Aaron sent MIDI, he sent DIs, he sent all of it. And it was like meticulously cleaned and ready for anything. It was ready for us to do whatever we wanted to do, but it was like, still everything was so like ironed out perfectly.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I that was a weird thing for me to experience, tracking guitars, like tracking, you know, leads and stuff, because of how meticulous he is. It's very polished. You're going to track it multiple times, double it, and then you're going to get every note slow, because he wants to have complete control over it. You know what I mean? When we worked with Aaron, we would go up to Seattle to record it. And I didn't live in Seattle. Our band's kind of stationed all over the place. Now we almost all live in a different state. But yeah, back then it was like, you had to make sure that he had everything before you left. And then when we started recording and Jeremiah joined the band, he became our producer. That was a much easier process, because him and I both lived in Nashville. We could spend as much time as we needed. There was never any situation like that.
It's like both a good thing and a bad thing, I think, that way of doing things, the Aaron method, where you have to get it all done before you leave. Mm-hmm. The good thing is, I feel like that keeps projects from just going on forever.
Sure. Yeah, you don't have a lot of time to sit with it.
Yeah, that could be good or could be bad. There's a case to be made for it being like, when you're working, you know that you have to get it done by this time. That's it. Like, so you're going to get it done.
It makes it a little more stressful too, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. That's the flip
side. Every lead take, you better nail it.
Yeah. So speaking of, did you write leads on the spot, or did you come in knowing them note for note?
How did we used to do it back then? Ryan, we did a lot of, he would just do GarageBand demos, send them by phone, and then I would just play them through my phone and play along with them. So I didn't have tracked ideas. I just would have, you know, I've been tinkering around with it, and then I just take the ideas I've got in my head up there. But then as we went on, songs were a lot more complete, especially as I was starting to write. We just send complete songs over, including the solos.
Got it. I want to go back to the songwriting thing that we were talking about. You said that you would just write everything and send everything to Ryan, regardless of how small the idea was. Is that what you were doing since you joined the band, or is that something that you started doing after those first two records? You're like, I'm going to write, so here, have at it.
Anytime I've written a song, I almost always finish the idea. I have very few songs that I just leave out there, and like throwaway riffs and stuff. I was never one to just kind of have this pool of riffs and piece together a song. I would always just have an idea, and I would, whatever the theme of that idea was, I would just finish the entire thing. And sometimes it'd be grueling. Sometimes I just wouldn't want to finish it. I didn't like the idea, but even some of those, Ryan ends up picking those songs in some of those cases where it's like, I really just wasn't digging this, but I made myself finish it anyway because it popped into my head for a reason. So I just try and finish it.
So, okay. So when Ryan gets your songs, does he cut parts out, or does he just lay vocals over them? Like, How does that work?
So the process is usually we'll have like a giant Dropbox folder and I will send 20, 30 something songs and he will just choose which ones are he's feeling like putting vocals on, and then he just puts vocals on them and sends them back over.
It must be fucking cool though to get vocals back from him just because he's such a good singer.
It is my favorite part of the process. The whole creation part is my absolute favorite part of the whole thing. When you start getting vocals back, and it's the best.
Yeah, I can only imagine because it's something you had no idea what it's going to sound like, right? Like you have no clue what is going to come back.
There's absolutely no telling. He could sing over it. He could just be screaming over it. There's just, you don't know.
It's a lot like a director shooting a movie before they have a score for it.
Yeah.
They don't really know what the music is going to do. Might have some idea, but it's still has to fundamentally change the way that they interpret their own work.
Yeah, I would imagine so, because they put those little placeholder songs in there. It might sound completely different than that.
Yeah, exactly. So they've shot this whole part with that placeholder. It's interesting. So when you get the songs back with his vocals on them, does it change your perception of the song at all? Like how you envision it, or like...
I try really hard. It is hard to do sometimes, but I try not to just get attached to anything in particular. So when I send a demo over, if you look at the amount of songs that I send him and the ones that actually get cut and put on the record, it's a very small percentage. So the odds are that this song isn't going to be anything to anyone ever. So I don't get really precious about it. I just put it out there. If he picks it, fantastic. If not, on to the next one. It could change the vibe of what I initially intended. So we did a song called On My Side. It's all like triplets, just open B triplets, like Meshuggah or something. And I just envisioned, because of the way the song is, the mood of the song, that he would just be screaming over it. But when he sent vocals back to it, he was singing over all those parts. So sometimes that flip is like, I didn't expect it. I didn't envision it. And it turns out way better than I had imagined.
All right. Yes. I hear the triplets. It's a sick riff.
But it's pretty aggressive. So I expected him to be screaming over it, but then he started singing.
So that had to change your perception of it for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
What a cool surprise.
Yeah, very fun surprise.
Well, I think that one of the secrets to not getting precious about stuff you write is to write a lot. And I've talked about this on this podcast before, but I've had experiences with musicians who write like three riffs a year or like a song a year. And so then when they're presenting that, that's 100% of their output for whatever project it is you're working on. So they take that a lot more seriously. So say that they wrote three riffs for the song and you cut two of them, you just cut 66% of their creative output.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
For that project. And that's, yeah. I mean, honestly, I get more of my stuff cut than that, but I write so much that, it ends up making up 90%. So I think that like the key to not getting precious is to just write a lot.
I agree. You don't have to write like a bunch of stuff and just, it's just junk because it's so much stuff. Like I said, I try and finish every idea and put a lot of like effort into each one. But like you say, do a lot of it. Stack the odds in your favor.
That is it. The percentage of my own stuff that I trash that doesn't make it. So I was just listening. I'm like writing an album right now. And so periodically I'll go through everything, every version of every song for this time period, because I scrap lots of riffs and I forget about them. And I want to see if maybe there's some gold there that I forgot about from like version 30 of a song that I wrote 50 versions of. As much as I like stuff in the moment, obviously, if I'm writing it, I like it. It doesn't pain me at all to let it go. And it is because I come up with so much stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
So much stuff. It's crazy. So much stuff I don't remember that I came up with most of it, I guess. And I'm just really surprised hearing earlier versions of a song that are completely different. But it's never an emotional thing for me just because of that. Because I know that, like, look, if this doesn't get used, I'll just sit there and come up with something else.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's always more.
There's always more. I'm amazed you don't have a song graveyard.
Well, I guess I kind of do, because there is a ton of songs that Ryan has not picked to be on records.
So what happens with those?
Absolutely nothing. They're in my Dropbox right now. There's a ton of them.
But, like, do you think to yourself, maybe, or, like, does it ever show up on, like, a later record? Or are there any where you're like, man, got to do something with that?
Well, yeah, I suppose there's a lot that I wish something would happen with them eventually. There's even some that Ryan has vocalized that he wants to do something. It's just like not knowing when or what that is to do with them. Mm-hmm. Who knows if that will ever happen, but there's a steady pool of a song graveyard to pull from for sure.
Yeah, that song I was just talking about, the one with the 50 versions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the riffs in that song is from our 1999 demo. And the demo was never released. We wrote this demo and then never did anything with it. We just went on to the next one and the next one. But, like, that original demo, no one's ever heard it. And there were a few riffs on it that to this day, it pissed me off that they didn't get used. Out of all the hundreds and thousands of riffs that I've written since, there have still been a few from, like, back then that, like, just never died.
See, that is a good riff. If you are still thinking about it to this day, you have to use it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm wondering about. Is there anything like that for you where it wasn't picked for whatever reason, or it got picked by something, but then on some project you were in at some point, but then never released, or, like, didn't live up to what you know its potential is, and so it just kind of burns a hole in your head?
There's actually a couple songs that Jeremiah and myself started another band. There's actually another band with this name now, which sucks, because I really loved the band name. We called Bronco, and we played one show.
It's a good name.
Yes, I loved the name. And it was like a Motorhead type band. And there were some songs that we did for Bronco that I thought were really awesome. And I think about quite a bit that I'm bummed that we didn't keep it going, or really, we have, like, demos of it recorded, but that we never actually did anything with it is a bummer. It's sitting there, it doesn't know what to do.
So maybe not dead forever.
Maybe not dead forever. I hope not.
Okay, good. I'm just glad to hear you say that, because I do actually think that it's a good thing to not get precious and to be cool to let most of them go. But at least in my experience, it's impossible to feel like that about every one of them, because some of them just don't fit a project.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And you spend so much time, at least I do, because I'm not an engineer in any way, shape, or form. I know what I need to know to get it down. But the amount of time that I spend on each one, it's a considerable amount of time. So you can't help but be a little bit, have some sort of attachment to it.
Well, you have to. I mean, like, it's music you're writing. It's weird. It's like while you're making it, you got to be all in. But then once you bring it to the table, it's almost like you got to detach to some degree from the outcome.
Yes.
To some degree, but not really, because you're still going to be attached to the outcome, because you're going to record what becomes the outcome. But like you have to have this, it's like this balance of like being passionate about it, but also being willing to let it go to the graveyard if that's what makes sense.
Yep, that's exactly right. And like you said, that's why writing a ton and recording a ton helps alleviate some of that pain of maybe something that you wanted not making it.
Do you have any system for, when I say tracking, I don't mean like recording. I mean like keeping track of your ideas or anything like that? Or you get them down, you finish them right then and there, and then send them off?
So I used to do something that was like, it's like a psychopath move. I would keep every song in my head.
Oh my God.
My justification for that was if it is truly a good, like, catchy song, I will remember it. And so I would keep like 10 songs in my head at once, and then I would purge. And I did that for a long time. It actually just changed for what I'm writing now, where I'm actually like, when I'm sitting down just noodling on guitar, that's usually how ideas come out. I track them just with my phone. I just have like a laundry list of notes. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm tracking every idea as it comes, as opposed to trying to cram it all in my head and then purge it.
I've heard people say that before, but that just sounds really like scary to me.
It's a psychopath move. It's risky, because like you could forget a really cool part that you just you just are blanking on. Yeah, it's so I don't do it like that anymore, but that is what I did for a long time.
The thing is, like, human memory is not a great thing. And memory also morphs over time. So you might think you're remembering it, but you're changing it. So like every time you think about it, you alter it a little bit. And so by the time you actually record it, it could be very different than that initial idea. And that's not to say that it's better or worse, but I have a hard time believing that it's identical.
Sure.
Just because of the way human memory works.
And your day is filled with all kinds of other things. You're not thinking about that song 24/7.
Yeah. Like, you're not reinforcing it.
I would run through them like in the mornings. That's when I used to do most of my writing. In the morning before I'd go to work, I would sit there and I would play through the songs that I was currently remembering. They were on the list. And I would play through those every morning. So, but that's not to say it couldn't, you know, it could be little variations here and there, but I wouldn't like put it in the memory bank and then not touch it again. I would usually revisit it daily.
The reason that I don't, like, I feel like it's a fallible method is because think about songs that you did write, that you recorded, released, have played on tour that you know are good songs. And how many of those have you had to relearn? And those are songs that like you actually did like learn all the way. And like played multiple times. Like, I don't mean it, maybe you didn't have to relearn the whole thing, but like, haven't you had to like practice like a song from 10 years ago that you just haven't played since?
Oh, absolutely. I think what may have helped is, like I said, I played for a country guy at the time. Those shows would be 4 hours long. I'm remembering 4 hours worth of music.
That's nuts.
At once. So at the time, it didn't really seem like it seems crazy to me now. But at the time, it was no shirt off my back.
Wow. I'm just impressed. I'm also terrified.
At 3 and 4 hours of playing guitar, like, you don't love it anymore. You don't want to do it.
I guess more than anything, I'm hoping that people don't try that. It's different if you're already playing 4 hours a night and are like already into your career and you have a method. That's one thing. But I'm speaking to people right now who are struggling to write at all, or who like have never gotten anything off the ground. That's a scary way of doing things.
Yeah, definitely don't. 100% do not do it like that. Yeah, do not do that.
One thing in the Riff Hard group that comes up a lot is people talk about not having the inspiration to write, or when they write, it all comes out sounding like somebody else or the same or whatever. And I have my opinions about how to get around that, but I'm curious, what's your take on those types of feelings?
I just take inspiration from so many other things. Like, you know, I play in this metal band, but I listen to so many other kinds of music. I do listen to like almost specifically 80s and 90s country music. I listen to a lot of pop music. Ryan and I always talked about how we loved like Carly Rae Jepsen and like their really poppy stuff. Listen to a lot of electronic music. I feel like there's so many different places to draw inspiration from, especially electronic music. There are some great beats to, and not just like the four on the floor, but like really weird. Go visit some like Deadmau5 stuff. He does a lot of odd timed things that you could pull rhythms from. That, you know, is a lot of really cool ways to draw inspiration from other things other than just other metal bands.
So I just call it like getting the light bulb to come on. That's how I see it. Is like, all I'm trying to do is get the light bulb to turn on. Once the light bulb is on, it's just, you know, it's on. And so the inspired state versus the not inspired state is, I don't look at it anything other than the light bulb's on or it's off. And so if it's off when I need to write, my challenge is, how do I get it to come on? And I've noticed that almost always I can get it to come on. It's just different things work at different times. So like, sometimes it's on from the moment I sit down. It's just on. Sometimes it's not. And sometimes like, you got to start writing and write some crappy riffs, and then a good one happens, or that's not working. Maybe learn a different piece of music or practice something new, like just a new pattern. Just like, you got to do something to wake your brain up. So I'll just find what that is that's going to work at that moment. So like, you know, I was going through some Jason Richardson exercises the other day. I spent like 30 minutes racking my brain on complex fingering, and then just like strummy riff started happening in one of the keys that I was practicing his arpeggio shit in. Nothing to do with what I was practicing, but like that's what got the light bulb to come on from. And like it's just a matter of like putting in the right stimulus, I guess. So that's what I do. I sit down and I do work. And then eventually it comes on. But look, sometimes it's not going to happen, right? And in those cases, I just decide that I'm going to just practice that day. So like I'm trying to always make progress. So if the writing is just not in the cards, then I have plenty of stuff I need to be practicing anyways.
I really like that. It's like pushing through, but you've taken your mind off of how the writing is not going well. You put it towards something else, and then the light bulb just went ahead and kicked on as soon as you took your attention off of it.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Is so just committed to making progress. So, and by doing that, it just comes back on. Waiting is like the worst thing you can do. So when people are like, take a break or whatever, like, I feel like that's rarely the solution. That's the solution when you're actually exhausted, you know, when you've been working and you're out of juice and you need to regenerate. That's when taking a break is good. When people say, if you're not inspired, just take a break or live life or whatever. It's like, no, just like keep working.
Shift your focus.
Shift your focus, but you got to keep the progress happening in my experience.
Yeah, because a lot of times a riff or something just comes from practicing scales or something boring. Like it'll just come out of there and you're not really trying. I find the times that I do get frustrated writing are the times where I do just sit down to try and write specifically instead of just what I know works. And that is just noodle around, practice something. And then it just kind of organically happens.
That's the light bulb on.
Mm-hmm.
Really is that simple, I think.
I do too. I think people try and overcomplicate it.
Yeah. Also, I feel like if you're writing the same riff over and over, or like there's some artists that like they have such a recognizable sound that they're impossible to rip off. Like, so Lamb of God is one of those.
That is exactly who I was thinking of.
Yeah, because of the way they use triplets, right? It's so theirs. And they're one of the bands that get ripped off by local bands a lot. What I feel like is if you're doing that, if like, you're trying to write and all that comes out is like bad Lamb of God, stop listening to Lamb of God for a little while and learn something else.
Yeah, listen to something else.
Listen to something else. It really is that simple. Like feed the brain something besides Lamb of God.
Yeah.
Do you find, Patrick, that like, you know, with the Country Project and Showdown and like all these different things, like how do you keep it clear, like what you're writing for? Or is it just you write so much that it's just out of your hands at that point? You just send it to Ryan, the end. And like you're not worried about like if it's too much in one direction or too much in another.
With Demon Hunter, we can do something incredibly heavy, or like I sent over a song for when we came out with War and Peace that was done all on keyboards. So I can do like a death metal inspired song, or I can do something like that where it's all electronic. But when it comes to like when I was writing for the Showdown, it's almost specifically one type of thing. It was one kind of very Pantera inspired, Black Label Society inspired music. You know what I mean? So it was I was drawing from a lot less inspiration other than just those things.
And so when you're writing for a project that has those types of, I guess, creative constraints, do you find that more or less difficult?
I don't know. I guess you're in a smaller box. So I guess that limits the creativity for me a little bit, but it also lets you know exactly what you're going for. There's no guessing. I'm not sure if it'd be more difficult or not. It just definitely puts a limitation on it.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't put like an entire electronic keyboard song for the Showdown. So it's like, I wouldn't get to do stuff like that for sure.
Yeah. Sometimes I think creative constraints are a good thing.
They definitely just let you know what the goal is going to be.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't know. Maybe saying limiting is the wrong way to put it, but you definitely have a guide.
Yeah. I mean, a project has an identity and there's like, it's almost like a checklist of like things that make up that identity. And so within that, be creative within that, within those parameters. And I think in some ways it makes you be more creative because you have to create something unique within those parameters. You can't just do anything.
Right. I kind of feel that way with writing for Demon Hunter. I feel like in the end, Ryan's voice is going to go on top of whatever music this is, and it will just inevitably sound like a Demon Hunter song. So it could be anything.
It's like personality, right? Like no matter what, you're still you. And I think that musical personality is not something you can get away from. It's something that you can expand it by learning more things, I guess. But at the end of the day, your tastes are your tastes, and you're going to always be biased towards them. There's not really much of a way to change that. So I feel like as long as you keep getting better and you keep doing more, you'll have a broader, like a broader palette and a broader sonic identity, but it's still going to be you. You're still you. Can't get away from yourself, for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a good place to end the episode. Patrick, I want to thank you for taking the time to hang out. It's been a pleasure, and love your band. I'm a big fan.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Anytime, man. It's been a pleasure.